Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 16th in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today we're going to be talking about education. With me is Tony Jensen, Brittany Harvey, Maggie Flores. The first question for the panel is this. Public education, for the most part of the last century, was based on the premise that if you were a child in America, you were entitled to a free, taxpayer-funded education from first to 12th grade. Does that premise still exist? Is there any evidence to suggest that it is no longer a widespread belief? Tony, you have been here before, so we're going to go to you first.
Sure. I think from the perspective of Alaska specifically, it's like Article 7 of Alaska's Constitution guarantees an opportunity for students to have public education. So I think very specifically for us, it is something that that premise still does exist. I think that is also a bedrock foundational aspect of what most people believe in the United States, that we have free and public education for K through 12th grade.
You hear that, Brittany?
Yeah, I also think that it's a normal of our society that children go to school for free through K through 12, which is paid by the taxpayers. I think that what should be added is that preschool is also paid for, because I feel that is a very important part of development in children. And where it is available for some students, it's not available for all. So that is a change that I would like to see.
So that it's not really as widespread. Or are you just talking about the early elementary stuff?
I'm talking about preschool. Okay. Predominantly. Right now, there are programs that allow children to go to preschool for free, but it is not for everyone.
Maggie.
I believe that tax-paid education for children through K through 12 is a standard in the United States. What I observed, though, is an increase in the amount of homeschooling in those years, suggesting that even though it's a standard, it is not perhaps the best environment that parents these days want to raise their children in.
So you're saying that the environment of the homeschool or the environment of the public school is?
The environment of the public school.
Is relating basically to parents' decision to homeschool their kids.
Many are.
Mm-hmm. Okay, since public schools are funded by taxes collected by the government, is it fair to say that the service or education provided is a government service? Are we really talking about public school service being government?
Absolutely. I mean, it's taxpayer provided, so it is a government service. If there's a different context in there, it's like, what is the government trying to get out of it? That might be a different topic, perhaps. But one of the basic functions of public education is to teach people how to be better citizens or how to operate within our society. It's the civic virtue that goes all the way back to the Greek and Roman times. And so that has been continued on, and that is something that we do see, and that's very much a government function. They just house it within public education.
Okay. So it is a government service. Brittany, you believe that?
I think it is a
government
service.
Okay. Maggie, you think it is?
Yes, I believe it is.
Which takes me to the next question. Since the days of Reagan, there has been a big push by the Republican Party to reduce or eliminate taxes in all forms. You already all have read these questions before, so I'm sure you've prepared the answers. Has that push adversely affected the quality of education?
Personally, I wasn't here during Reagan's time, So I would have to just speak about my own educational experience and say...
Are you saying we're all old here?
I'm not saying that at all.
All right, go ahead.
I think that it hasn't affected schooling at all. I feel that schooling has been politicians' main focus, and a large amount of our budget goes into schooling.
So you believe it's adequately funded then?
I'm not sure if it's funded 100% adequately, but I think that it is a top priority.
Tony, you're a high school teacher in the public school system.
I am.
Tell me what you think about that.
From a fiscal perspective, I don't believe that education is, from a federal perspective, funded at the same level as many other things. I mean, just look at our defense budget compared to our education budget. But I do believe that it has been a priority for a number of things, but I would say that it is inadequately funded, especially when we see the year-to-year discussion debate within the state legislature, the borough assembly, and the federal government about how much funding we're going to put into public education. And if we're putting specific riders on those things about what it has to go towards to fund instead of just allowing communities to make their own best decisions for their community.
No funding, Maggie?
I believe there's inadequate funding. The evidence is across the nation. We have many programs in the grade schools being dropped, many classes being dropped. Curriculums depend more on standard testing than they do on thinking. There has been an increase in grade school and middle school teachers where their class sizes are huge and they don't have teaching assistants and they're doing it all. I personally sent a lot of goods for a classroom up to the village, a village, Kotlik, in Alaska, because they weren't funded high enough to even have things for the school for a year. So I think that maybe privileged schools probably get what they need, but I think there's a spectrum of them across the United States, and I think that in a lot of the schools, they're underfunded.
And what you said also works at the high school level, too. There's a lot more students per class. We just tend to talk about a little bit more at the elementary school because it becomes a little bit more obvious or prevalent for the younger students because mm-hmm. we're used to seeing smaller classes for them. Mm-hmm. I know personally I've had a couple classes of 55 students. So,
is education as good now as we remember when we were school-age students? I mean, we're talking about we have some practitioners here, some teachers. We have three teachers here and one student here. Do we remember education as being as good?
I would say no. I would say it's actually better now than it's ever been.
I would have to agree with that statement.
What do you think, Maggie?
I think that during my time, which is different than yours because of age, we didn't have the technology that's present today, and the technology, from a teaching standpoint, reaching a student is fabulous. It really is. The visuals and the availability of the extra tools to bring concepts alive for everyone, including visual learners. However, in this type of technology age, when I compare it to simpler times when I grew up, I think that rather than pushing a button to see if I got multiple choice right, in my classrooms I was encouraged to think a little more critically.
But also one of the things that we've seen is over the course of education, at least in public education, is that it's really moved from the idea that it's just rote regurgitation, rote memory of things with some thinking attached to it, to now we're, one of the things we like to say in our school district is that we're training students to do jobs that don't exist. And so we are much more forward thinking rather than teaching them the skills that they need to exist currently and only for currently. We're actually giving them opportunities to delve into areas that we aren't even sure what's going to be there. And technology is one of those tools, but the opportunity for more courses for students to take, as well as a wider spectrum of opportunities and school choices and being able to go to different schools throughout, just even within our school district, I think is a lot better than it's ever been. And the educational research and understanding of how students learn is also way beyond what it ever has been. Just as we move forward, we get more information, and so we can make good decisions based upon that.
I'd like to take an adverse position on what you guys are saying here. One of the things that I noticed in teaching 8 years at Matsu College, teaching math, teaching algebra, was that there was a real deficiency in many of the students in not knowing their times tables. I mean, you talk about rote learning and how, you know, we were moving away from rote learning. Well, one of the things that we had to do when we went to school was we had to learn our times tables. And we have a situation now where I experienced huge difficulty in having students learn how to factor because they didn't really see that 8 was the sum of 3 plus 5, and they couldn't see that 15 was the product of 3 times 5. And because they had such inability to know their times tables, I had a big problem with a lot of them and teaching them how to factor. So I think that, you know, in that sense that you're talking about the trends of how we're moving to this way so we don't have to go back and do as much rote learning, I think that discipline that we lost in the rote learning is something that we really should have considered as a valuable aspect of our education. Please respond.
I would agree with you in that there is some definite aspects and positives of just the rote memorization of certain things. But in my field, in social studies, it was just drill and kill. Remember all the dates and facts and then just to spew them on a piece of paper. And that's just really not dynamic. And one of the things that our school district has talked about for a number of years now is that that kind of knowledge is ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. They can look it up faster on their phone than I can tell them. Mm-hmm. And so I don't need them to memorize that kind of information, but I need them to understand the connections between why things happened. So I'm more interested in chronology than I am in just straight memorization of the dates and facts without the understanding. In things like knowing your times tables, sure. But those same kids that can't do the times tables probably can outcode all of us and can write those programs that many of us end up using for apps and so on, even if they don't have that skill off the top of their head.
Maybe. Maybe not. All right. How would you assess the effectiveness of Bush's No Child Left Behind legislation and Obama's Race to the Top initiative? And what I'm basically talking about is the funding that is tied to test scores. I'm sure you've had that experience, Tony, in your school. The funding that was related to the test scores, whether you got the high test scores meant you got the funding or not.
I'm not familiar with that part of the test scores connecting to actual funding. I know that there's been some talk about in different places, not specifically in our school district, of bonuses for teachers tied to test scores and things along those lines. I think that that's not inherently a fair way to assess what it is a individual does in their classroom. But I think there's some decent parts of the concepts behind No Child Left Behind or Race to the Top. I think the execution of it didn't quite pan out. We're all in favor of accountability. I don't know anybody that is a professional that doesn't think that they should be held accountable. But like was mentioned earlier, I'm not sure that standardized tests is the best way to measure that accountability because that oftentimes is just based upon what the student had that day and the mentality they had going into that test that day. And it's just a snapshot of one day in time for that student. And that's not the fairest way to measure them. And that's definitely not the fairest way to measure teachers, I don't think.
Or also if the students had breakfast that day before they took the test.
Sure, there's a lot of factors that go in that.
Yeah. Brittany, Race to the Top, No Child Left Behind?
Well, speaking of testing, my daughter hasn't had the opportunity, I guess, to be a part of testing yet, but she says she already has anxiety about it for next year when she does begin. And she asked me if she can just stay home those days. How am I supposed to react to that? Am I supposed to send my kid to school and test her? You know, I don't know.
Standardized testing, Maggie. Should we tie funding of the schools to those test scores?
I don't believe we should. I don't have a lot of experience with that. I've always been college, university level, so we don't engage in that. However, at that level, having taught chemistry and mathematics, what I see is a lot of anxiety over standardized testing to enter professional schools, MCATs, VMATs, veterinarian, nursing most definitely for boards and stuff, but that's kind of a different thing.
But those are adults. These are like children, right? Through like third.
Oh, yeah. That's what I said. Yeah. I don't have a lot of experience with it is what I started with. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's the things I do have experience with, which aren't the same.
One of the nicer things about some of the standard, there's value in some of the standardized testing. Like one of the things that our school district does is the MAP testing, which is the measures of academic progress. And for a number of our students, it gives you a starting point. And then if they do it, most schools do it at least twice, if not three times a year. And so you can see the measurable growth from their fall entry score to their winter to their spring. And that's data that our school district would like to use and does use for student placement to make sure they're getting the resources that they need for those students. And then PEAKS is supposed to be measuring the same thing on that. We're kind of doing some initial understanding of what PEAKS actually gives us in working with the state on that part. But there is some value to it. But I know when my own children were in elementary school, it felt like every day they weren't learning anything. They weren't being taught because, oh, what'd you do today? Oh, we had this test. What'd you do, you know, last week? Mm-hmm. Oh, we had that test. And so I think that causes some, you're just testing the data to see what it is that they have, but you don't really know what they're actually getting and they can't use it. And so that's one of the downsides of standardized testing.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed was that you had these high schools that were located in an area of affluence where the testing scores were really generally a lot higher, and then you had a lot of these urban schools where the kids were struggling with poverty issues, and the affluent schools would get more money because their test scores were higher, whereas the impoverished schools would not. So what do we do about that? That wasn't a question that was on the list.
No, so. You sprung on us.
I didn't prepare anyway.
I can see two reasons why we should give more funding to schools that have better scores. They are doing the work, they're putting in the time, and so are the parents. And yet the schools that don't have high test scores, why should they not have the same sort of funding? Because they don't have as much, they're in poverty-ridden areas, and their parents may not help them as much on their homework because they're working, right?
Or they're working, or they're drug addicts.
Or something, yes, right? I was going with the positive there.
Right, right.
Uh-huh. So if we give the same amount of funding to each school, then perhaps those students would be able to get more help.
Well, let me just ask this broad question. Does the way we fund now, is it an equitable method of the way we fund now? Or are there any ways in which we could approve the distribution of the funding over, say, a school in an affluent area as opposed to an urban school?
That is a very political question because that's what our legislature ends up arguing about at the state level quite often. And Alaska is a little bit more unique than other states in that in Alaska we have a very small amount of school districts. You don't have a lot of the suburban school districts right outside of like Seattle Public Schools, and you have five or six right outside of the city limits, and same thing with Los Angeles and other major cities. That's where some of the money changes, because if you have most school funding is done at the local level, and so if your school district is putting out the levy or the bond or whatever, and you have the local area that is affluent, they're going to pass it, and their schools are going to get that money, and that's not as much of an issue as when you have in locally funded large school districts where maybe it is a more impoverished area that can't afford additional. And so you do see that. I taught in Washington State for a year, and that was one of those things, is that there is a relatively impoverished area and they could never pass a levy to fund their schools adequately, but the school district right down the road, 10 miles away, was always doing very well. And so that's not something we could fix at a local level specifically, but you would have to change the entire funding formulas and different things like that at the state or even the federal level. And so that becomes a problem to try to do that easily.
Okay, I'm going to list categories of stakeholders in the American educational system. If I miss any, please feel free to mention them so we can add them to the list. So I'm going to start off with school boards and school administrators, teachers, students, parents, support staff, taxpayers, politicians, and society at large. Okay. So these are all people that are involved or have a stake in America having a good educational system. Are there any more that I didn't include on the list you can think of?
I think as soon as you said society at large, you kind of got everybody.
Okay. That takes us all in then. How would you rank each of the categories' contribution in order of importance to the educational process? Are school administrators more important than students? Are students more important than parents? How would you rank that?
Well, when you were looking or reading off the question, I think for me the question became, well, what sense is most important? Like if we're talking about outcomes, then one would think like families and students are most important for the outcomes. If we're talking about imparting the knowledge, then you're talking about teachers. If you're talking about funding it, then we're talking about taxpayers and politicians. And so I guess maybe what were you thinking in terms of direction of the outcome?
That's what I wanted you to tell me.
Oh, okay.
You know, what you thought was the most important as far as, you know, the various ways in which you described it. So I like the way that you delineated that.
I would say as a teacher, students are most important because it is their education. They're the ones that it's their future for whatever they want to get out of it. And so parents and administrators and teachers and the community can't work harder than the students can. It's their education. And so I would think they are the most important stakeholder in all of that.
Okay. We're going to stay with that particular topic, but I need to remind everybody that this is Radio Free Palmer, KVRF, and we are here with Tony Jensen, Brittany Harvey, and Maggie Flores talking about education today. Stakeholders. Tony gave a pretty good delineation as to the stakeholders. Does anybody else care to comment on the order of importance?
I think that the three most important people on your list were students, parents, and teachers. They are the three. They're the triangle. They're the trio that make an education what it is, because a parent has to back up what a teacher teaches, and they are the first teacher of a child. They raise them. They give them all they need when they're younger, and then when they go to school, they need to also be teaching them at home. And then, of course, teachers, they put everything they have into teaching the student. But if a student isn't willing to learn, then all is for naught.
What do you think, Maggie?
Well, I have to agree very much with what's said. For adult learning, I would put it in the order since parents aren't so involved.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with what both of you said. For adult learners, I believe it's the student, then it's the teacher. And school administrators have a big part in it. School administrators at the university level are the ones that pull for the veterans, pull to make sure they're maximizing their ability to use their educational rights. They pull for people who are not veterans, who really want to go back to school. And so without perhaps the financial department and deans and things like that, and I agree, it probably depends on the institution, but at my institution, it's real teamwork at the school administration level to make sure people are getting what they need. I had a nephew in a very impoverished school in California, Rio Linda, and when I went to graduation for his sixth grade, they were given shoes, okay, by the teachers pooled to give these children shoes. And so there, I think the students and the teacher and the lack of parents, thank goodness these teachers were there.
Well, not necessarily lack of parents, but lack of resources in the family to have schools. That's kind of a heart-wrenching story there. We're going to move to like a different topic, which Maggie, you and I are quite familiar with, and that's adjunct professors, which is another name for part-time college instructors. Most post-secondary institutions have more adjuncts than full-time professors employed. What is the value of adjuncts in post-secondary educational processes? Do you consider the compensation adequate or fair in lieu of their contribution? We're talking about adjuncts now. Do we think they're important?
Of course they're important. Because they're providing a service that the university needs. I adjunct at Matsu College for a couple of years, and
what'd you teach there?
I taught Western Civilization and Western Civilization I and Western Civilization II.
Okay. Yeah.
So in my time there, I think that with some limited resources, I mean, obviously the two of you have more experience at that level, but in the limited resources that Matsu College had at the time, that was a way for them to try to maximize what they could offer for their students as they're kind of transitioning between just being a community college and trying to be more of a four-year type of university or moving into that direction. I think you are able to use a lot of adjuncts with real-world experience or business experience or experience in their field that maybe a professor that's lived in academia for a while doesn't have, and so you give a different aspect to it, not necessarily better, but just different, and that provides other opportunities for the students to gain some different knowledge. When it comes to compensation, I thought I was fairly compensated, but I wasn't doing it for my primary job. I have a friend that primarily adjuncts in another state, and she teaches like 5 or 6 different classes at different universities as a way to try to make a complete income for her just through adjuncting. And so in her sense, it would not be an adequate pay.
I guess I'm not familiar with what an adjunct makes, but do I see the worth in them being there? Of course. Some of my best professors that I've learned from this year and last year were adjuncts. They were always there, even though they per se didn't have office hours or an office on campus. They made time for me. They emailed me, they called me, they texted me back, and I am completely grateful for their knowledge.
Adequate compensation for adjuncts, Maggie?
Well, I've been an adjunct in California at a college and then became full-time there. I taught chemistry. And and then when I was full-time, I taught many chemistries. And I've been an adjunct at Matsu College, and I've been an adjunct at Wayland University and then became full-time there, math science there. In terms of compensation, in California, we were well compensated. But, you know, that's, of course, not the goal. If you have the passion to teach, like I have the passion to teach, everything comes in that needs to come in. In terms of my adjunct experience at Matsu, not so compensated. At least for core classes. My experience there wasn't that these were courses to offer them for more breadth in their education. These were core classes needed to go on to university experiences and professional experiences. And so not so well compensated there at all. At Wayland Baptist University, it matches the compensation by far that the compensation did in California for adjuncts. And at Wayland University, there's a high regard for adjuncts and what they bring to the table in professions other than being an adjunct professor.
Okay, let's move back to public education. Is it a good idea to reduce funding for art, music, and theater programs in order to focus more resources on the basics, such as reading and math?
No.
You don't think it's a good idea to reduce those?
Absolutely not.
You think...
I think a lot of the research shows that students being able to have a broader educational experience is going to be a valuable thing for them. I think that being able to express themselves musically or artistically actually will help with math understanding and connecting those things. I think that public schools were founded around the concept of the liberal arts, which a major portion of that is going to be non-core curricular things. And so it's the well-rounded, the whole education of a child. So no,
that makes a better citizen.
Makes a better citizen, makes a better person, makes a more productive person and citizen, yeah.
Okay. Any comment on that, Brittany?
Yeah, I think that there should be funding for arts and theater and music, because you use a different part of your brain when you're doing art, when you're playing music, when you're watching theater. And I think it helps a lot with the crossover when you're doing math and when you're writing a paper and being able to express yourself and having those different kinds of opportunities. I think it makes a well-rounded person. And I personally, when I was picking out my daughter's school, I made sure to find a school that also thought of the whole student instead of test scores and math. And while important, all the whole child is important.
You seem to agree with that, Maggie.
I certainly do.
Okay, this is KVRF. We are Bridging the Gap with Tony Jensen, Brittany Harvey, and Maggie Flores. Today we're talking about education. Yeah, I think I already went past the adjunct professors list, so we're going to move on to private schools. Should they be funded by public dollars?
I don't think so, because the charter schools and the public schools that we have are under some sort of accountability and rules, and the private schools don't have to follow the same rules. They get to make up their own. Their teachers don't have to have teaching certificates, and so if parents want to send their students to those schools, then they should be privately funded.
Okay, should we put homeschooling in that same category then?
I don't think so, because you get those. There is accountability for parents to teach their schools if they get public dollars for their funding.
They have the homeschool programs?
Yeah, the ones that I have been a part of anyway.
I would agree with Brittany on the idea of the homeschools that are affiliated with the local school district, like Massey Central School, as a homeschool option for students and parents. I believe that one does have a lot of accountability for what the students are learning through their independent studies with their parents or on their own.
How is that accountability expressed, or how is it?
So they have a lead teacher that you go and meet regularly, and they either give them tests. I only homeschooled my daughter for 1 year, so I mean it was kindergarten, and we would meet with them, and they would help us pick out our curriculum and ask her questions and do a report card. At the older levels, I'm not sure.
I believe that I haven't taught at the Massey Central School, but I believe that it's a similar thing. They do have lead teachers, and they do have projects that are organized with a certificated teacher and somewhat supervised by those teachers and at the school, and that has to go in through the school. I agree with Brittany also. I don't believe that private schools should be funded by public dollars, because the private schools have complete control with no stakeholder review of the public for what they're actually getting for their money. And so if we give taxpayer dollars to a private school that is maybe religiously oriented, and maybe you're a person that doesn't believe in that certain denomination or belief, then why do your dollars have to fund that? And I think that's an argument that a lot of people have. But in turn, at public schools, you have a general understanding of what's going to be taught and what's not going to be taught, and you have the opportunity to influence that through school board and other things that you might not at a private school.
What do you think, Maggie?
No, I have nothing to add.
Okay. So we're talking basically about the voucher system, about giving every student a voucher and making the choice to go to a public school or a private school. So you basically are not in favor of that voucher program then?
Most of the research I've seen with voucher programs show that there's no discernible benefit for the students that actually receive that. And the downside of the voucher system is that if you don't meet, in theory it sounds really good, but if you don't meet the standard of that private school, and so that school has the opportunity to remove you from their school because it's private, they can kick you out. Where does that student now go? They go back to the public school, which no longer has that amount of money, but they still have to do the job of educating that individual. And so that right there tells us that the society still believes and is based upon the idea of a public education. And so if we allow students to do that to a private school, that can then kick those kids out for a variety of reasons that a public school could not. That student still goes back to a public school. And so then we're now underfunding our public schools because that money is still held by the private school, because most private schools don't offer a refund.
You brought up a topic that I don't have listed here, but I think it'd be a good idea to talk about it anyway, is the idea of kicking people out of school, kicking kids out of school. Is that a viable way of imposing accountability discipline, or does that really just throw a potential criminal out in the street earlier than would be normal?
I don't know that we go automatically to criminals just when kids are suspended. So we've got to be careful not to make that.
I'm talking about expulsion.
Expulsion?
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to get expelled from schools. And the main thing that I would believe, I don't have the statistics on this from our school district, but I would believe that we only expel students for seriously egregious things like violence and larger quantities of illegal substances in our schools, not for relatively minor things. So those are the, you're right in that those are the potential criminals, but we also have things to try to recapture some of the students and allow them to continue an educational process through different programs that we offer in our school district. And so I do believe that.
We call it AE, Alternative Education in Pennsylvania. Do you have something like that here?
We do. When we have, I don't know exactly the mission because I haven't worked at either of those schools, but we do have the acronym is PACE. And then we also have the day school for students that are integrating in or out of our public schools. And I don't know completely their mission, but I do know that that is another alternate setting that we have done for students that have faced expulsion or long-term suspension so they can continue their education. Because eventually they're going to have to be members of our society.
Then we would rather have them functioning as citizens as opposed to incarcerated as criminals.
I think most of the statistics bear out that the more educated you are, the less likely you are to start pulling from other programs and costing the government money. And so, like in my civics classes, we talk about either you're contributing to society or you're pulling from society. And so the people that are in jail or undereducated aren't getting those types of jobs that are higher paying, so they can't pay higher taxes. So then now we consider them to be pulling from our society as opposed to contributing. And so the more education you get, generally speaking, the more income you make, which then means that you're going to be paying more in taxes, which then contribute to the society at large.
What's the difference between a public school and a charter school? Can we define that a little bit? I'm looking at you, Brittany. Yeah, I want you to tell me because you have a child or you have children in charter school?
I do.
Okay.
I feel like a charter school has a specific mission or grandfathering idea of how they want to teach their kids, whether it be Montessori or Waldorf or Reggio Emilio. There's different kinds of teaching styles that charter schools are able to incorporate into their curriculum while still being under the school board and abiding by the accountability that they have.
Of the public school district?
Yes.
Okay. And how is that accountability applied at a charter school? Any differently from the public schools?
No. I don't believe so.
Just pretty
I'm
much
not
the same
part
way.
Of the admin of the charter school. So
I would even say to some extent there might even be a little bit more. There's another level of accountability because now not only are you accountable to the school district and school board and the public writ large, but you also have your parental supervisory board that also gets to have a lot of input into what goes on in the school. And so I would say it's even another level of accountability.
So have you participated, Brittany, in that
board? Yeah.
That supervisory board? Yeah. So could you describe that oversight for us a little bit?
So there's an academic parental council or something. I don't remember. I think it's called the APC. They work with, or I think actually the principal works under them, and they help pick curriculum and the principal and the teachers. I think there's a lot of accountability within a charter school.
Now, do all charter school teachers have to have the same certification as in a public school?
For a teaching certificate?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
In Alaska, that we do require that. I do believe that I know within our school district that our charter schools are all the teachers that are there are all certificated teachers, and they are actually still school district employees. So they're not in that realm of private school. I don't know if that's the case for all charter schools throughout the United States, but I know in Alaska that is kind of how it's been set up.
Is access to charter schools available to all school-age children?
So there's a lottery for most charter schools that I've toured, and I believe that all students have the ability to be in the program.
In the program?
So I would say yes, they have.
In the program or the lottery?
In the program. They put in for the lottery, and then they have the ability or the opportunity to be chosen from that pool of people and join the school.
Yeah. I think within the first couple of years of a charter school opening, while they're still building up their numbers, mm-hmm. I don't know that there's a lottery, but as soon as they reach their capacity, then the vast majority of charter schools do have to go to a lottery system in order to make sure that it's fair and equitable for everybody to have the same opportunity to get in. Some charter schools, many charter schools are allowed to grandfather in families. So if you have a sibling that attends, then that generally gives you either a better opportunity or an automatic opportunity to continue on. But not all charter schools do that. But the lottery system does allow for that equitable aspect of everybody having equal opportunity for access.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. We're talking about education today with Tony Jensen, Brittany Harvey, and Maggie Flores. Sports has become a big part of educational institutions. A graphic example of that connection was vividly portrayed recently in the HBO production of Paterno, starring Al Pacino as Joe Pa. I don't know how any of you saw that. It was pretty profound. How is sports working out in educational institutions? Do you have any suggestions on adjustments to that relationship with sports and schools that would improve education in general? Are we okay with sports in schools?
In the American public school system, I think sports are a foundational part of the experience.
Is that more traditional or more institutional, that experience?
I think it's a chicken or the egg argument, perhaps, is that I'm not sure if it is. I know a lot of things are done by traditional, but it is institutionalized in that public school, Texas and the Friday Night Lights and football games and things like that, that's institutional for them, and it is traditional as well. I think sports are a great extension. All co-curriculars are a great extension of what we as teachers try to do in the classroom, because there's a lot of lessons that we can teach them in the abstract in the classroom, and then they become a real learning experience on the field or on the court or as a co-curricular, in the competition that they're in. And so I think that is a great opportunity for students to do that, and they're as important in many cases as a lot of the different things that we do within our school. And it's the main reason why a decent number of students actually make sure that they attend school. It helps with attendance, and they know that they have to have certain grades in order to be able to participate. Mm-hmm. And many of them have aspirations of playing collegiately or professionally, and so there's a certain level that they have to achieve in order to get to the next level. And so you might get some of those students that wouldn't necessarily be engaged for a variety of reasons that now make a connection with their coach and get the help that they need or get the extra tutoring they need in order to move on to the next set of goals that they have.
And become a better person through sports.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think about sports there, Brittany? Good thing, bad thing?
School sports, children's sports. I think it's a good outlet. I think sports can be important. I don't really have too much involvement with any high school or school sports right now. So,
what do you think about sports, Maggie?
Well, I don't have – I had involvement with it down in California at the college level, and it was important. It was important not only from the individuals, the students, for all the reason you said, that got involved in sports. Mm-hmm. We probably wouldn't had some of those students even attempting a junior college education had it not been for the draw of the sports. It's important for the families, and it's important for the other students that go on Friday night and interact, and it forms a little community, a positive little community. So I think it's a very good thing.
I think an underlying aspect of the question you asked, though, is in some areas, at the university level for sure, and even in high school level, there are some students that are over-celebrated for their athletic achievements as opposed to just being a good student-athlete. And that's problematic, and that's more of an individual case-by-case thing as opposed to sports in a broader spectrum. And I don't think that's a good thing. Whenever you start telling somebody that they're better than everybody else because they can jump higher or run faster or do something else in the context within the school, you are better than everybody else, that becomes a little difficult. They should definitely be celebrated for their athletic achievements, and they can make millions of dollars at it, but that's not necessarily what we want to tell them at the high school level, that that is the only reason why they're there. And so a nice balance between the two, I think, is important.
Right, right. I think there's been a danger of it being corrupted by the putting it on a pedestal, celebrating it more so, deifying the athlete as opposed to just saying, well, you know, you did very well in this because you achieved in this area, and diminishing others because they're not as athletic or because of it.
That's a broad societal thing, though, too. That's not an educational specific thing. That's not something that we at the schools do on a regular basis. It definitely happens, but that's not what we do normally. That is something that society, through professional leagues, and then it starts trickling down to college and how much, you know, people get involved in watching collegiate sports. And then now it's trickled down into, hey, we're going to have this special news program to show which school this high school athlete decided to attend for 1 year before they jump into the professional levels. And that's a societal shift that we've had.
Do students have any voice in the nature of education? Should their involvement in administrative decision-making be enhanced or limited? The role of students in making choices as to how they are taught. Is that something that we should look at or something that we should just disregard?
Well, I think absolutely. Going back to your earlier question about who's the most important, all three of us agreed that students are probably one of the most important stakeholders in education. One of the nice things within our school district, a couple of the other hats that I wear is that, one, I'm the student government advisor at Wausau High School, but then also I'm the student advisory board advisor for the school district. And the student advisory board for the school district operates like a district-wide student government. And what they do is they get together and they talk about some issues that they see collectively within the school district and work for positive solutions. And so in that sense, the school district, and they have a student that gets to sit on the school board and provide advisory reports and so on. And the school board takes those seriously and takes it under advisement what the students would like to see improved in their own educational experiences.
Are there any specific recommendations made by the board that
all
have been implemented?
Yes, all the time, actually. And on a larger scale, actually, our students at all the different high school levels attend the Alaska Association of Student Governments, where they do this on a statewide level. And so some of the things with the teacher training for suicide, so understanding the signs of suicide, that actually started as a statewide student government resolution that then made its way to the state legislature, and Betty Davis ended up sponsoring that bill, and it got passed. And so now, as a teacher, I have to make sure I get training in suicide awareness. At the district level, one of the things that the students have been talking about for a number of years is the idea that they want to see more awareness for the environment. And so they've been talking about recycling, and they've done a lot of research, and the district has now this year put out for bid single source recycling. So it's a step in the right direction to try and get recycling in all of the schools. They wanted to see an update to the health curriculum. And so a few years ago, when the health curriculum went through a rewrite, a couple of students were invited to sit on the health writing team to give a student perspective of, hey, these are the things as students that we think we need to know about. One of the biggest things that came out is that the high school level was talking about introducing cyberbullying as a component to the high school curriculum for health. And our students were like, no, by the time you get to high school, we've already been bullied for 3-4 years online. We want it in sixth grade. And that was kind of an eye-opener for some of the writing
second
team.
Second grade.
And so they asked to have it implemented in the middle school curriculum. And so that would be another direction that way. And at the local level, my student government works with our administration to try and do different things to enhance the student experiences, whether through co-curricular activities or looking at bell schedules or lunches or things like that. And so I think students have a great voice, and it should be well utilized.
Okay. Brittany, you're a big participant in that aspect of the student, because you're the president of the student government at MATSU, correct?
I am this year. But on a smaller level, with my own children, if they want to learn something and they tell me that they want to learn something, they're gonna want to learn that material, whether if I choose a topic that I think that they need to know. It'll be a lot harder for me to put that on them to have them understand it. But if my son comes up to me and says, I want to learn about dinosaurs, he's intrinsically motivated to learn all that information about dinosaurs.
So in that sense, they're kind of like designing their own curriculum.
Yeah, they're designing their own curriculum, and I can mold it in a way where I incorporate math, where I incorporate history. But if he tells me if this is how I want to drive it, then I will let him drive his own education in a way.
One of the things that Tony mentioned earlier, which is a word which I really feel is a very important aspect of education, was accountability. My belief is that without accountability for teachers, parents, students, and administrators, that education rarely succeeds. Can you just share with us in your experiences where accountability was a positive or the lack of accountability had a negative impact on the educational experience? Is there anything that you can remember where accountability came to play in your experience as an educator or a student? You're always first, Tony.
Always. Oh, I know. I wanted to see if they wanted to jump in before.
That was very
talking.
Gentlemanly of you.
So I think in all professions, everybody agrees with the idea of accountability. And we understand intrinsically that if we don't hold ourselves accountable, then nobody else will. But on the same note, that's one of the things that students have to learn for themselves. It's an emotional maturity thing. It doesn't mean they're immature. It's just they haven't learned how to do that yet. And so that's where the roles of the schools come in to hold students accountable. And we do this through grades and attendance policies and other things like that. And so that part's good, because if we didn't do that, then the basic aspect of the system wouldn't work and students wouldn't learn what they need to do to hold themselves accountable at their job. So like if we let students use cell phones all the time in school without any structure to it, then they're going to do that at their place of employment, and they're going to end up getting unemployed. As a teacher, you know, I'm no different. We all have our own self-interest. And so if I didn't know that I had a boss watching me, you know, I would like to think that I'm going to hold myself accountable, and I would. But there's sometimes that I start getting in my own direction and I don't see the broader picture. And that's what the principal's job is, to come back. It's like, hey, let's get you moving back this direction so we're all moving the same way, and you're starting to go a little bit off. And it works the same way up to the principals are held accountable by the superintendent, and the superintendent's held accountable by the school board, and ultimately by the public. And so I think our levels of accountability are there, and nobody likes to have a bad teacher or somebody that doesn't hold them accountable, because, again, we all kind of like to know that we're doing a good job, or if we're doing something that isn't so great, that we know what we're doing wrong so we can fix it, because I believe that to be a basic aspect of human nature, that we want to do good.
So are there any bad teachers who are not held accountable that you I'm not asking for any names or anything, but have you seen the lack of accountability with poor teaching?
Sure. I think that in every profession you're going to have a few people that aren't as good as what they should be. And that's where the principals or the administrators have the tough job of having those hard conversations. Like, this is the thing that we need you to do in order to become the type of educator that we need you to be. And some people are able to do that, and other people aren't. And that's one of the things that where people rail against the union. The union doesn't want to protect bad teachers. Nobody wants a bad teacher. Nobody wants a bad employee. It's that we need to make sure that we have things in place so that those principals can actually have those conversations and move teachers on to a different career field if they aren't able to meet the standards that we need for our students.
Thanks very much, Maggie, Brittany, Tony. Mike has given us the we are out of time signal. So I want to thank you all for coming by, and that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.